Hi everyone, and welcome to Reflections. So for most people who know me, know I'm curious about a lot of the subjects that I come into contact with through my work, whether that's individually with clients or the organizations that I've worked with or the people that I've come across. But last year, when I went to a festival with my friend, there were many authors there, and one of the books that I bought that you can only read backwards is The Curious History of Dating. And this is from Jane Austen to Tinder. And I wanted to share this book because it is fascinating. It's from Nietzsche Hodgson, and it's a new approach to romance, and it explores heroines of Regency novels and what it could teach us in today's dating world. So, of course, dating's never been easy, and the true love, the road to true love has always been rooted with heartbreak, challenges, and difficulties, and we hope with lots of excitement and fun too. But how did the Victorians come out? How did love blossom in war-torn Europe? And how did the 80s video dating never take off? So this book really explores the history of dating, but also what forms our ideas and attitudes about relationships. And that's something I'm always fascinated by. Many of the clients that I work with are in relationship with people, and many of the difficulties and challenges and stress that we face are through our relationships, whether it's our children, our parents, or our significant others, whether that is someone we've just started to date, so we're dating, we're feeling the early stirrings of anxiety and excitement, or whether it's a relationship we've been in for a number of years. So it starts with in 1786, it was truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a large fortune could find a wife via the Lonely Hearts ads. Did you know that in 1786, there were ads published in the Times newspaper in the UK? They'd existed for 100 years. And by any of Mr. Darcy's contemporaries jumped out of the hay cart. So here's one of the ads. A gentleman of very considerable fortune, about the age of 40, offers himself as a husband to any well-educated, amiable, and agreeable lady of good character and not more than 30 years of age, and as much younger as may be, who will undertake to exercise those attentions which his particular situation requires. Although finding a husband was paramount, there were more years for it than our impression and era gives. As Jane Austen points in Persuasion, it sometimes happens that a woman is handsomer at 29 than she was 10 years before. Although the more years a woman remained at home without a husband, the more she's drained the finances of her family. That's, of course, if you're born into a family that has finances. By the end of the 18th century, there were people ready to do the hunting for you and with a promise of faster return in the form of marriage brokers, such as the new matrimonial plan provided a helpful grading system by which you could figure out if the broad-shouldered yet slightly stout gentleman in the naval uniform was suitably well-born enough for your very well-read, very pretty sister. And wouldn't catfish you. Making a good match was no less important for working men. So this is where the working class came in. An essay published in the volume one of the Ladies' Magazine in 1770, quotes, courtship may be sure to be either the ruin or happy settling of every young tradesman who engages in it. Contrary to the courtesy manuals of Renaissance or the 17th century, which were all about men perfecting the art of flattery and getting underneath a lady's petticoat, and would appeal to the women's sense during the smiling days of courtship, Frances Friendly wrote in the Ladies' Magazine. And as we know, back then, women couldn't attend a theatre, a dance, or a dinner without a chaperone. So balls were the one of the few guaranteed opportunities for flirtation. And rich families invested large sums of money to give their daughters a season in London, which ran from March to June. Coming out was crucial if you wanted an opportunity to find a rich husband. Watch Bridgerton, it chronicles that amazingly. So it was 1753 when the introduction of the Marriage Act came in, a piece of legislation designed to put a stop to fleet marriages. Until 1753, English law merely required couples to say their vows in front of a clergyman. So the clergyman wouldn't really know whether or not they were already a bigamist, which apparently was also a problem back then. So in order to ensure that couples did not use it merely as a way to cover up a prior marriage or a scandal, this license was required, £100 bond. That's quite a lot of money back then. Becoming a mistress was also lucrative, and one of the only ways in which women could be truly financially independent. In the Morning Post, apparently a top-notch mistress could command as much as 100,000 a year. Rather progressively, an affair wasn't always conceived as the woman's fault. As the writer Frances Friendly mused in the 1770 edition of the Ladies' Magazine, can such husbands wander as a wife seeking for pleasure and entertainment abroad? Question mark. So we know that many young women in the upper middle classes came out anywhere between the ages of 16 and 18. It was more about social mobility than a romantic one. Now, the idea of dating and courtship, which is really covered in this book, so I think you should get it, was given that courtship was seen very much as a trial period. Women were encouraged to test out their potential husbands for evidence of any ill feeling towards their families, or that they had some past that they hadn't shared with them. Once engaged, though, there was a tight code governing on how the couple may behave in public. They were urged not to show off their status, for example. For women, according to the Lover's Guide in 1885, a lady should conduct herself almost as though she was already married. All other suitors, if possessed more than one, should know that she's already accepted. Given that engagements could last so long, they were usually, in some ways, high-risk ventures, particularly if your partner were to pull out 4 years in. For a woman, this was four fertile years wasted, maybe another 4 years ahead of you to sit out another engagement. Old maidenhead beckoned while feckless fiancés bandied about. So the remedy to the situation was that women started to bring breach of promise suits. Did you know 875 breach of promise suits were brought before the English courts between 1750 and 1950? So this idea of how long you date for before you get married was really where it started. And it could be up to 4 years, 4 years before you find out he's a tad. So, and it was women that brought that forward into the courts was by women of lower middle class and working upper working class. So there were very few interesting defences, and the claim that your fiancé was unchaste, you could cite illness, immaturity, or mental incapacity as reasons for not getting married. And pregnancy was actually seen as the greater proof that discussion about marriage had indeed taken place. So in 1850, though, claims for breach of promise increased significantly. The sly impetuous had cottoned on to the fact that you only need to produce one witness to your alleged marriage proposal for it to stick. So you could end up quitting. Meanwhile, did you know the breach of promise still exists in the US today? A recent case in 2013 saw Georgia, a mother of four, given up work to raise her and her fiancé's children, awarded £50,000 compensation after he broke off their engagement 4 years later. So the breach of settlement is actually what paved the way for the Divorce Act in 1857, where you had to prove to be able to sue your husband for divorce if they committed adultery or had deserted them for 2 years or done them physical harm. So it wasn't until the 1880s where women had a right to own their own property and custody of their children, whether they'd been unfaithful or not. But ahead of the divorce lay the option of refusal in the event that an unsuitable suitor made an unwanted proposal of marriage. So just as the middle to upper class young lasses came out and did a season to try and attract a suitor, it was actually much more difficult for working class women who were toiling away in factories and mills to come into contact with anyone. But they had more freedom than their middle and upper class counterparts when it came to sex and courtship. In particular, music halls were really popular back then. And as an entertainment venue in the 19th century, all the best ingredients for today's strip clubs, alcohol music, scantily clad performers, attendees, and an atmosphere of off-the-clock revelry. Now, these places were actually frequented by women until about 1852, when the Canterbury Music Hall in the UK and Lambeth in London introduced the concept of Ladies' Night on Thursday. It was the brainchild of owner Charles Morton, who thought it would civilize the men. Ladies' Thursday, in fact, turned out to have the opposite effect. And as soon as the gentlemen in attendance were appearing with anybody but their wives and fiancés, when it begun as an attempt to celebrate Thursday as a prime date night, had turned out as a full-on infidelity club. So by 1870, the Married Women's Property Act came in. And it was really where the balance of power started to shift and also affected the courtship dynamic. Because up until then, women had inherited and owned property based on getting married. So now the heiress could retain her land and houses when she said, "I do." So it meant that either she could come into contact with more cads, or that she could even question whether or not she wanted to get married at all. And it was the free there was an additional conversation, and the free lovers of the late 19th century associations were set up. Contrary to the idea that it comes up, it wasn't preaching about what to do outside of marriage. It was actually looking at satisfaction within personal relationships. So in 1891, the idea was that when women learn that their best and their highest objects in life is to be independent and free instead of living to make some man comfortable, when she finds out she must first be happy with herself to make others happy, we shall have loving, harmonious families and happy homes.